Accession number 8843, roll number 1.
Colonel Scrope, reel 1. Where were you born, Colonel Scrope?
1913.
Where was that?
Ripon in Yorkshire.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a qualified barrister, but he broke his spine hunting at an early age and was an invalid for much of his life. He also was a Yorkshireman.
Where were you educated?
The Oratory School.
And how did you decide to go in for the army?
Well, quite honestly, originally I was destined for the Navy, but I failed the medical test for Dartmouth when I was 13, and I eventually came into the army afterwards.
Did you find that your Sandhurst course was very relevant for what was to come later?
Actually, I didn't go to Sandhurst. I came through the back door, through the supplementary reserve, but I took the passing out exam from Sandhurst after going to a crammer's and got a regular commission in 1934.
How did people react? How did you and the people round about you react to the declaration that we were at war with Germany?
Well, I think that everybody thought it was inevitable. We'd known for a long time that it was pretty well inevitable, and I can't say more than that. I was actually home and leave from India, and on mobilisation I joined our 1st Battalion in Catterick.
Did you come across anyone who was opposed to the declaration of war?
Oh, not in the army, no. Oh, no. It's our job.
Did you find any, come across anybody who was who greeted it with enthusiasm?
Well, it's difficult to say whether it's enthusiasm. I think they look forward to it. Who knows, a new experience. And, a lot of them were very keen indeed.
What did people at that time think about our chances in a war against Germany?
Oh, pretty good. At first, until they had experience of it. I mean, to give you an example, when we were going to Norway in 1940, my battalion happened to be the reserve battalion, and there weren't enough warships to get us across in one flight, and we were the third battalion to go. And we were all very concerned that we wouldn't arrive in time for the triumphal entry into Oslo. Well, it wasn't that at all, of course, and we were only 6-7 days in Norway before we were driven out by vastly superior strength.
Did the period of phony war take you by surprise, that there should have been this long period without active hostility?
Yes, I suppose it did. We sat doing very little in France from October 39 until it started up in earnest. We did do one short period down in the Saar in front of the Maginot Line, and we were just about to go and do a second one when we were ordered up to back to Scotland to embark for Norway.
Did you and your brother officers feel impatient with the phony war, or did you just accept it?
I think we just accepted it. We knew it had come to an end sometime. It was rather boring just sitting there doing nothing. A terrible winter, very wet. We did dug slit trenches and they all filled with water, and it then we had to build up ramparts instead. It was a tiresome period. Long time, from October to March.
Was there any suggestion amongst your brother officers that the British and French should take the offensive, or did you feel that we should have waited for the German offensive?
I think we realised by then that we wouldn't stand much chance if we launched an offensive against the Germans, and I think we were rather waiting to see what happened.
Did you ever consider at this time that you there would be a possibility of hostilities in Norway?
Not specifically in Norway, no. No, that came as a surprise. Norway was invaded before the Low Countries, and of course the reason we went there primarily was because of the Swedish iron ore supplies which came out through Narvik, and it was essential to get those to deny to the Germans.
Can you remember when you first became aware that there was a chance of going to Norway?
Yes, in the middle of the night once. As I say, we were just getting ready to entrain to go down to the Saar again for a second stint in front of the Maginot Line, and that was suddenly cancelled. The CO was summoned to brigade headquarters, and we got the orders you're to return to Scotland prior to embarking for Norway. That was all the warning we had, and we went off the next day.
When you say we, who was that?
The 15th Brigade of the 5th Infantry Division. It was only the one brigade that went to Norway. The rest of the 5th Infantry Division stayed in France and fought and were evacuated through Dunkirk.
And the 15th Brigade was made up of whom?
1st Battalion of Greenhards, 1st Battalion King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and the 1st Battalion of the York and Lancasters.
Was your battalion up to strength when it went?
We did get some reinforcements when we were at Dunfermline prior to embarking for Norway. Very nearly up to strength.
And what equipment did you take with you?
Just our normal battalion weapons. We had things like fleece overcoats because of the cold in Norway. It's still pretty cold in April in the mountains of Norway. But no special equipment. In fact, the astonishing thing about their campaign was that we were one brigade of infantry with no supporting arms of any sort facing the oncoming German army. There was two battalions of another brigade out ahead of us, but they had a terrible time, and there was very little left of them by the time we got there.
How were you provided with accommodation at Dunfermline?
Tented camp, I think. As far as I can remember, it was a tented camp. We were there about a week before embarking. We got some reinforcements, and we generally got organised to go. We thought at first it might be an opposed landing in the Trondheim area. In fact, when we went, it was unopposed, and we went to Ordnance Nest. We just pulled up the quayside and disembarked. By that time, you see, the Germans were still in the Oslo area and were just beginning the advance up the Gudensdalen, and we went down and met them halfway.
Did you do any special training at Dunfermline?
Wasn't time to do much. It's mostly administrative, I suppose.
How did you actually get across?
We went in three destroyers and one cruiser, the Birmingham. A company on each of the three destroyers, and the rest of the battalion in the Birmingham cruiser.
Was it just a matter of a few hours?
The crossing? No more than 24. Just over 24, I suppose.
Did you see the enemy at all at any stage?
Crossing the sea?
Yes.
On one occasion only, an aeroplane, one evening, just we were approaching the fjord at, leading up to Ordnance Nest, an aeroplane came out of the sun. Now, we were expecting an aeroplane to come and contact us, but in fact it was a German bomber, and it dropped three bombs astride Birmingham, but in fact they're all near misses. Paint came down to the roof of the cabin I happened to be in at the time, and the The ship was completely untouched, apart from being shaken by the near explosions. That was the only occasion we encountered the enemy on the way across. Now, as I said, we were the 3rd Battalion of the brigade to land at Orm's Ness, and the first indication we had that everything was not going according to plan was when we went round a bend in the fjord leading to Orm's Ness. We saw Orm's Ness ahead of us, just a smoking ruin. Smoke coming up from it, and everything burnt to the ground.
You crossed on the Birmingham, did you say?
I went on Birmingham, yes, which was the battalion, there's 3 companies, the 3 companies being in destroyers.
Can you tell me what happened once you got to Ondel's Ness?
Yes. At first, there was nobody there at all. And the CO and I went ashore. I was Edgerton at the time. And a bit later, an assistant brigade major, we had one for that campaign, came down and contacted us. There was a train there with a lot of red crosses on the top of it. And we were told to entrain and move forward to Donbass. We had to remove all the red crosses off the trains before we were allowed to get into them. And we moved off, and the next day we got to Donbass. And we stopped there for a short while. We detrained, and we lay up in the woods. You see, the enemy were nowhere near us at that stage. There were 2 battalions right ahead of us, down at Shur and Kavam. That was the KYLI and the York Lancasters. And there was a certain amount of air activity, and they dropped incendiary bombs on us more than anything else, more than HE when we were in Donbass, and burnt the woods down, and the house, which was temporarily being used as battalion headquarters, was burnt to the ground with all my kit in it and the COs.
Did it take you by surprise when you were instructed to go straight to Donbass?
No. We knew we were moving up country to meet the Germans. And you see, we were 100 miles apart when we landed. More.
Can you describe the countryside at Donbass?
At Donbass, yes. Well, Donbass is a modest-sized town in the middle of the Gudbrandsdalen, which is the big main valley which runs north and south in Norway, coming the whole way up from Oslo to Donbass and then on down to Åndalsnes, except it's got a different name, but you know, it's going downhill to Åndalsnes.
Was it a wide or a narrow valley?
Varied a bit. No more than, let me see, mostly half a mile wide.
Was it
the wider bits to it and narrower bits, gorges.
Were there lakes or not?
Yes.
And wooded?
Wooded, very wooded, yes.
When you reached Donbass, did you see anything of the Norwegian army?
2 Norwegian ski companies were put in support of us, and they operated in our flanks. You see, there was snow on the hills, whereas most of the valley was fairly free of snow. It's still semi-frozen.
What impression of the Norwegian units did you get?
Keen, but probably didn't know a lot about warfare.
What gave you that impression?
Difficult to say. I suppose we knew they'd had virtually no experience of it, and they rather go in for guerrilla war is their speciality, really. They're an individual nation, and they operate individually or in groups. And they're far better at guerrilla warfare, or that type of warfare, than conventional warfare.
What nationality arms did they have? Where did the arms come from?
Oh, I had no idea. I don't know. I can't remember now. I probably did know, but I can't remember.
Can you describe what happened to you personally next?
Well, we went to Donbass. Then the brigade commander visited us very briefly and told us what the situation was, which was that the KOI and I were down in Kavam, and the York and Lancashire in Shua. It may have been the other way around, but I think that was the order. And the first thing we had to do was detach one company, our B company, and send it up in support of the York and Lancashire. They left the battalion then, and we didn't see them again until the battle at Otter. And our instructions then were to re-entrain and go forward to Otter, which might have been 30 miles, and there to take up a defensive position, a battalion strength, across the Gubensdalen, and to dig in and be prepared to fight in that position, and that the battalions in front of us would in due course withdraw through us, and we'd become the frontline troops.
And did you do that?
We did precisely that, yes.
Can you describe in as much detail as you can what exactly happened?
Well, the battalion entrained, moved up to Otter, we detrained there. I went with the CO and the O group into Otter Station to start with, and that's where we had our first encounter of enemy fire, because a couple of German airplanes came over and they saw us in the station and they strafed us. Actually, there were no casualties, but that was our first experience of fighting on the ground.
How many planes were involved?
There were only two at that stage. You see, we're a long way behind the front line then. We saw a lot more later on.
Was much damage done or casualties?
Well, it was only a machine gun fire. Casualties, nil as far as I know. But it scattered the O group pretty effectively.
Did it have any effect on morale?
Oh, no. No.
What happened next?
CO did his reconnaissance, which I went with him, and he decided where he was going to position his companies, two right forward and three further back. We had a fifth company. There were domestic reasons why we had a three company, primarily because only 97 soldiers could fit on a destroyer, so each company was reduced to 97 strength, and the surplus men were made into a fifth company called Y Company. And anyhow, that was all according to plan, and the battalion duly moved forward and dug in the positions which the CO had allotted them.
How long were you there?
About 24 hours before the other battalions withdrew through us. We then became the frontline troops, and the Germans started almost straight away probing towards us. We could see them coming up. We opened fire on them. We inflicted considerable casualties on them at that stage before they'd attacked at all. They put in certainly one attack at company strength, again probing to find out where we were, I think, and then they put in a battalion strength attack against us, both of which we defeated, and they were driven off. But we were only in that position actually fighting for 24 hours, and then the orders came through that we were to pull out and go back through the next battalion back to Donbass, in fact. And the following night the train again was our tame train was only half a mile behind the battalion headquarters, and at a given signal we all got up and went back, leaving one company as rear guard, got in the train and went back to Donbass, and that was the end of that particular battle.
What impression did you get of the German attack, of its quality?
Oh, I think they were efficient. I mean, they were good quality troops, they said. This was the vanguard of the German army coming up the Gubensdalen. And you see, we were never in contact, probably with more than a couple of battalions. It was a narrow valley, the Gubensdalen, and they couldn't attack on a broad front. They did try and get... You see, the reason for withdrawing... there were a whole series of withdrawals, you see. Both the KYLI and York and Lancs had previously done a tactical withdrawal from Schur and Kavarm, was that once they were up in close contact with us, they then started probing around the sides, and given another 24 hours, they'd have been in behind us, and we'd have been completely cut off. So it was necessary to pull out. See, I must stress that we had no supporting arms of any sort. The only thing we had were three Swordfish aircraft. Now, but we had no airfield for them. And so, when they weren't flying, they parked on a frozen lake. The Germans got wise to that pretty soon, and after dark they came over, bombed the lake, in went the Swordfish, and from that moment... the only aircraft in the air at all were German.
Did you see the Swordfish yourself at any stage?
I saw them over us, yes, early on. But actually, that was before my battalion was actually engaged in battle. It was while we were digging in our defensive positions. They were flying over, going over the KYLI in front. But then, you see, they went into the lake, and that was that. We had no aircraft. We had no artillery, we had no anti-tank guns, except the tiny little 2mm ones within the brigade establishment. No tanks, of course, no sappers, nothing. Just two infantry brigades, one infantry brigade, three battalions.
You say the troops dug in. Did they find it possible to dig down deep?
No, because you see the ground was really frozen. You get in a bit and put stones around, that sort of thing. Is building up as much as digging down. You could get in a bit, but difficulty. I mean, it would have varied in different parts of the front. Some were more rocky than others. And some, I suppose, were frozen more than others. But so they had reasonable defensive positions. We were never driven out of our defensive positions. We always held the line. Until we had to make an orderly withdrawal, which was on instructions from above. At one time, we had there were two Norwegian artillery guns which were sent up to support us. It's rather funny, the account I read afterwards in one of the reviews of the campaign said the Norwegian artillery, noisy but inaccurate, put great heart into the troops. I can well remember that from the account of it. It just about describes it. They blasted away. Heaven knows they hit anything. But it cheered us up, you know, to think there were a couple of guns behind us which were actually firing at the enemy, instead of having nothing to fight except small arms.
What was the morale of the troops like, in fact?
It was very good. Very good. No complaints about that at all.
What happened next after you withdrew from Otter?
From Otter, we went down to Donbass, and that was sort of became a brigade defensive position. But on the way, we blew all the bridges, which delayed the advance of the Germans, and it was some time before the Germans caught up with us. There was never a big battle at Donbass. It was only a probing one. But that night we received orders to withdraw from Norway altogether, to go back to the port of Ornesnes and re-embark in warships and go back to Scotland.
How did you greet that news? Were you surprised or not?
Well, we knew we were outnumbered. We had no weapons to speak of other than our own personal weapons in the battalion. No supporting arms. It was obviously a lost cause. And General Paget, who was the general in charge down there, he handled it magnificently, that campaign. And he did the best he possibly could against overwhelming odds. Literally overwhelming odds. They had everything in their favour, the Germans. But we fought well. No doubt about that. They never overran any position anywhere.
What about casualties to the battalion?
I forget the figure now. Not nearly as high as it might have been. Quite a number were captured. Some were wounded and captured. Others were killed. I'd say about 45, 50 killed. That sort of number.
Why do you think the casualties weren't greater?
Because the withdrawal action was handled so skillfully by the powers that be. He pulled out at just the right moment, held the enemy, inflicted what casualties we could on them, and then pulled out to a position further back and did the same thing again. There was no other way of fighting that campaign other than by a series of withdrawal actions. They were far too strong for us. In fact, we never fought as a brigade in line, if you see what I mean. It was only a battalion astride the Gubensdalen, three battalions in depth, in fact, perhaps 10, 15 miles apart. And it was a battalion, they were all battalion actions, not brigade actions. First the York and Lancasters, then the KOILI, then the Green Hearts.
Did you know at the time what size of forces the Germans were able to deploy against you?
Well, I would estimate there were never more than a couple of battalions actually engaged with us. I mean, there are obviously more coming up, and we'd have had a much stronger attack against us if we'd stayed on in the one place and probably been surrounded at the same time. It was easy enough for the Germans to get up the mountains and go round. There was only a company of ski troops up there to stop them, and once they got in behind us, we'd have been cut off. We'd have had no supplies coming up, and that would have been the end, probably. In due course, they must have overrun us, sheer weight of numbers. But because we withdrew tactically at the right moment, we were able to go on fighting withdrawal actions.
How did you get from Donbass to Arndalsnes?
Our tame train, the one we'd had the whole time. It was in a tunnel at Donbass. And what happened at a given signal, well, there were two companies of, I think, KYLI, who were the rear guard on the top of the tunnel, holding the valley there, the Gubensdalen, and the rest of the brigade filed into the tunnel and got into the train. At a given moment, the train gave a couple of hoots on his horn just to announce it was game, which is, there was a Norwegian driver, of course, and we steamed off. And the whole way we stopped at, kept stopping at bridges and blowing them to delay any advance by the Germans. But that train move wasn't terribly successful because we sent a pilot engine ahead of the train, which had the whole brigade on, to see that the line was all right.